My exhausting weariness began to disappear. My appetite returned. I gained weight. A few weeks later, I was able to walk with crutches. 6 weeks later, I was able to go back to work. I'd been making $20,000 a year, but I was glad now to get a job for $30 a week. I got a job selling blocks to put behind the wheels of automobiles when they're shipped by freight. I'd learned my lesson now. No more worry for me, no more regret about what had happened in the past, no more dread of the future. I concentrated all my time, energy, and enthusiasm into selling those blocks. Edward S. Evans shot up fast now. In a few years, he was president of the company, the Evans Products Company. It's been listed on the New York Stock Exchange for years. If you ever fly over Greenland, you may land on Evans Field, a flying field named in his honor. Yet Edward S. Evans never would have achieved these victories if he hadn't learned to live in day-tight compartments. You'll recall that the White Queen said, "The rule is jam tomorrow and jam yesterday, but never jam today." Most of us are like that, stewing about yesterday's jam and worrying about tomorrow's jam, instead of spreading today's jam thick on our bread right now. Even the great French philosopher Montaigne made that mistake. "My life," he said, "has been full of terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened." So has mine. So has yours. "Think," said Dante, "that this day will never dawn again." Life is slipping away with incredible speed. We're racing through space at a rate of 19 miles every second. Today is our most precious possession. It is our only sure possession. That's the philosophy of Lowell Thomas. I recently spent a weekend at his farm and noticed that he had these words from Psalm 118 framed and hanging on the wall of his broadcasting studio, where he would see them often. "This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." The writer John Ruskin had on his desk a simple piece of stone on which was carved one word, "Today." And while I haven't a piece of stone on my desk, I do have a poem pasted on my mirror where I can see it when I shave every morning, a poem that Sir William Osler always kept on his desk, a poem written by the famous Indian dramatist Kalidasa. Salutation to the Dawn. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence, the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Such is the salutation to the dawn. So, the first thing you should know about worry is this. If you want to keep it out of your life, do what Sir William Osler did. 1. Shut the iron doors on the past and the future. Live in day-tight compartments. Why not ask yourself these questions and write down the answers? 1. Do I tend to put off living in the present in order to worry about the future or to yearn for some magical rose garden over the horizon? 2. Do I sometimes embitter the present by regretting things that happened in the past that are over and done with? 3. Do I get up in the morning determined to seize the day, to get the utmost out of these 24 hours? 4. Can I get more out of life by living in day-tight compartments? 5. When shall I start to do this? Next week? Tomorrow? Today? Chapter 2. A Magic Formula for Solving Worry Situations. Would you like a quick, surefire recipe for handling worry situations? A technique you can start using right away, before you go any further in reading this book. Then let me tell you about the method worked out by Willis H. Carrier, the brilliant engineer who launched the air conditioning industry and who headed the world-famous Carrier Corporation in Syracuse, New York. It's one of the best techniques I ever heard of for solving worry problems, and I got it from Mr. Carrier personally when we were having lunch together one day at the Engineers Club in New York. When I was a young man, Mr. Carrier said, I worked for the Buffalo Forge Company in Buffalo, New York. I was handed the assignment of installing a gas cleaning device in a plant of the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company at Crystal City, Missouri, a plant costing millions of dollars. The purpose of this installation was to remove the impurities from the gas so it could be burned without injuring the engines. This method of cleaning gas was new. It had been tried only once before and under different conditions. In my work at Crystal City, Missouri, unforeseen difficulties arose. It worked after a fashion, but not well enough to meet the guarantees we had made. I was stunned by my failure. It was almost as if someone had struck me a blow on the head. My stomach, my insides began to twist and turn. For a while, I was so worried I couldn't sleep. Finally, common sense reminded me that worry wasn't getting me anywhere, so I figured out a way to handle my problem without worrying. It worked superbly. I've been using this same anti-worry technique for more than 30 years. It is simple. Anyone can use it. It consists of three steps. Step one, I analyzed the situation fearlessly and honestly and figured out what was the worst that could possibly happen as a result of this failure. No one was going to jail me or shoot me, that was certain. True, there was also a chance that I would lose my position, and there was also a chance that my employers would have to remove the machinery and lose the $20,000 we had invested. Step two. After figuring out what was the worst that could possibly happen, I reconciled myself to accepting it, if necessary. I said to myself, "This failure will be a blow to my record, and it might possibly mean the loss of my job. But if it does, I can always get another position. Conditions could be much worse, and as far as my employers are concerned, well, they realize that we are experimenting with a new method of cleaning gas, and if this experience costs them $20,000, they can charge it up to research, for it's an experiment." After discovering the worst that could possibly happen and reconciling myself to accepting it, if necessary, an extremely important thing happened. I immediately relaxed and felt a sense of peace that I hadn't experienced in days. Step three. From that moment on, I calmly devoted my time and energy to trying to improve upon the worst, which I had already accepted mentally. I now tried to figure out ways and means by which I might reduce the loss of $20,000 that we faced. I made several tests and finally figured out that if we spent another $5,000 for additional equipment, our problem would be solved. We did this, and instead of the firm losing $20,000, we made $15,000. I probably would never have been able to do this if I had kept on worrying, because one of the worst features about worrying is that it destroys our ability to concentrate. When we worry, our minds jump here and there and everywhere, and we lose all power of decision. However, when we force ourselves to face the worst and accept it mentally, we then eliminate all these vague imaginings and put ourselves in a position in which we are able to concentrate on our problem. Now, this incident that I have related occurred many years ago. It worked so superbly that I've been using it ever since. And as a result, my life has been almost completely free from worry. Now, why is Willis H. Carrier's magic formula so valuable and so practical, psychologically speaking? Because it yanks us down out of the great gray clouds in which we fumble about when we're blinded by worry. It plants our feet good and solid on the earth. We know where we stand. And if we haven't solid ground under us, how in creation can we ever hope to think anything through? Professor William James, the father of applied psychology, has been dead since 1910. But if he were alive today and could hear this formula for facing the worst, he would heartily approve it. How do I know that? Because he told his own students, "Be willing to have it so. Be willing to have it so," he said, "because acceptance of what has happened is the first step in overcoming the consequences of any misfortune." Would you like to see how someone adopted Willis H. Carrier's magic formula and applied it to his own problem? Well, here's one example from a New York oil dealer who was a student in my classes. I was being blackmailed, this student began. I didn't believe it was possible. I didn't believe it could happen outside of the movies, but I was actually being blackmailed. What happened was this. The oil company, of which I was the head, had a number of delivery trucks and a number of drivers. At that time, war regulations were strictly in force, and we were rationed on the amount of oil we could deliver to any one of our customers. I didn't know it, but it seems that certain of our drivers had been delivering oil short to our regular customers and then reselling the surplus to customers of their own. The first inkling I had of these illegitimate transactions was when a man who claimed to be a government inspector came to see me one day and demanded hush money. He had got documentary proof of what our drivers had been doing, and he threatened to turn this proof over to the district attorney's office if I didn't cough up. I knew, of course, that I had nothing to worry about, personally at least, but I also knew that the law says a firm is responsible for the actions of its employees. What's more, I knew that if the case came to court and it was aired in the newspapers, the bad publicity would ruin my business. And I was proud of my business. It had been founded by my father 24 years before. I was so worried I was sick. I didn't eat or sleep for 3 days and nights. I kept going around in crazy circles. Should I pay the money, $5,000, or should I tell this man to go ahead and do his damnedest? Either way, I tried to make up my mind. It ended in a nightmare. Then, on Sunday night, I happened to pick up the booklet on How to Stop Worrying, which I had been given in my Carnegie class in public speaking. I started to read it and came across the story of Willis H. Carrier. Face the worst, it said. So I asked myself, what's the worst that could happen if I refuse to pay up and these blackmailers turn their records over to the district attorney? The answer to that was the ruin of my business. That's the worst that can happen. I can't go to jail. All that can happen is that I shall be ruined by the publicity. I then said to myself, all right, the business is ruined. I accept that mentally. What happens next? Well, with my business ruined, I would probably have to look for a job. That wasn't bad. I knew a lot about oil. There were several firms that might be glad to employ me. I began to feel better. The blue funk I had been in for 3 days and nights began to lift a little. My emotions calmed down, and to my astonishment, I was able to think. I was clear-headed enough now to face step three, improve on the worst. As I thought of solutions, an entirely new angle presented itself to me. If I told my attorney the whole situation, he might find a way out which I hadn't thought of. I know it sounds stupid to say that this hadn't even occurred to me before, but of course I hadn't been thinking. I had only been worrying. I immediately made up my mind that I would see my attorney first thing in the morning, and then I went to bed and slept like a log. How did it end? Well, the next morning, my lawyer told me to go and see the district attorney and tell him the truth. I did precisely that. When I finished, I was astonished to hear the DA say that this blackmail racket had been going on for months, and that the man who claimed to be a government agent was a crook wanted by the police. What a relief to hear all this after I had tormented myself for 3 days and nights wondering whether I should hand over $5,000 to this professional swindler. This experience taught me a lasting lesson. Now, whenever I face a pressing problem that threatens to worry me, I give it what I call the old Willis H. Carrier formula. If you think Willis H. Carrier had troubles, listen, you ain't heard nothing yet. Here's the story of Earl P. Haney of Winchester, Massachusetts. Here's the story as he told it to me himself on November 17, 1948, in the Hotel Statler in Boston. Back in the 20s, he said, I was so worried that ulcers began eating the lining of my stomach. One night I had a terrible hemorrhage. I was rushed to a hospital connected with the School of Medicine of Northwestern University of Chicago. My weight dropped from 175 pounds to 90 pounds. I was so ill, I was warned not even to lift my hand. 3 doctors, including a celebrated ulcer specialist, said my case was incurable. I lived on alkaline powders and a tablespoonful of half milk and half cream every hour. A nurse put a rubber tube down into my stomach every night and morning and pumped out the contents. This went on for months. Finally, I said to myself, "Look here, Earl Haney, if you have nothing to look forward to except a lingering death, you might as well make the most of the little time you have left. You have always wanted to travel around the world before you die, so if you're ever going to do it, you will have to do it now." When I told my physicians I was going to travel around the world and pump out my own stomach twice a day, they were shocked. Impossible. They'd never heard of such a thing. They warned me that if I started around the world, I would be buried at sea. "No, I won't," I replied. "I have promised my relative that I will be buried in the family plot in Broken Bow, Nebraska, so I'm going to take my casket with me." I arranged for a casket, put it aboard a ship, and then made arrangements with the steamship company, in the event of my death, to put my corpse in a freezing compartment and keep it there till the liner returned home. I set out on my trip imbued with the spirit of old Omar. "Ah, make the most of what we yet may spend, before we too into the dust descend. Dust into dust, and under dust to lie, sans wine, sans song, sans singer, and sans end." The moment I boarded the SS President Adams in Los Angeles and headed for the Orient, I felt better. I gradually gave up my alkaline powders and my stomach pump. I was soon eating all kinds of food, even strange native mixtures and concoctions that were guaranteed to kill me. As the weeks went by, I even smoked long black cigars and drank highballs. I enjoyed myself more than I had in years. We ran into monsoons and typhoons, which should have put me in my casket, if only from fright, but I got an enormous kick out of all this adventure. I played games aboard the ship, sang songs, made new friends, stayed up half the night. When we reached China and India, I realized that the business cares that I had faced back home were paradise compared to the poverty and hunger in the Orient. I stopped all my senseless worrying and felt fine. When I got back to America, I had gained 90 pounds and had almost forgotten I even had a stomach ulcer. I had never felt better in my life. I went back to business and haven't been ill a day since. Earl P. Haney told me he realizes now that he was unconsciously using the self-same principles that Willis H. Carrier used to conquer worry. First, I asked myself, what is the worst that could possibly happen? The answer was death. Second, I prepared myself to accept death. I had to. There was no choice. The doctors said my case was hopeless. Third, I tried to improve the situation by getting the utmost enjoyment out of life for the short time I had left. "If," he continued, "if I had gone on worrying after boarding that ship, I have no doubt that I would have made the return voyage inside my coffin. But I relaxed. I forgot all my troubles. And this calmness of mind gave me a new burst of energy which actually saved my life." So, rule 2 is this. If you have a worry problem, apply the magic formula of Willis H. Carrier by doing these 3 things. 1. Ask yourself, what is the worst that can possibly happen? 2. Prepare to accept it if you have to. 3. Then calmly proceed to improve on the worst. Part 2. Basic Techniques in Analyzing Worry. Chapter 4. How to Analyze and Solve Worry Problems. I keep 6 honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are What and Why and When and How and Where and Who. Rudyard Kipling. Will the magic formula of Willis H. Carrier, described in Part 1, Chapter 2, solve all worry problems? No, of course not. Then what is the answer? The answer is that we must equip ourselves to deal with different kinds of worries by learning the three basic steps of problem analysis. The three steps are, 1, get the facts, 2, analyze the facts, 3, arrive at a decision, and then act on that decision. Obvious stuff, yes. Aristotle taught it and used it. And you and I must use it, too, if we're going to solve the problems that are harassing us and turning our days and nights into veritable hells. Let's take the first rule. Get the facts. Why is it so important to get the facts? Because unless we have the facts, we can't possibly even attempt to solve our problems intelligently. Without the facts, all we can do is stew around in confusion. My idea? No, that was the idea of the late Herbert E. Hawks, Dean of Columbia College, Columbia University, for 22 years. He had helped 200,000 students solve their worry problems, and he told me that confusion is the chief cause of worry. He put it this way. He said, "Half the worry in the world is caused by people trying to make decisions before they have sufficient knowledge on which to base a decision." For example, he said, if I have a problem which has to be faced at 3 o'clock next Tuesday, I refuse to even try to make a decision about it until next Tuesday arrives. In the meantime, I concentrate on getting all the facts that bear on the problem. I don't worry, he said. I don't agonize over my problem. I don't lose any sleep. I simply concentrate on getting the facts. And by the time Tuesday rolls around, if I've got all the facts, the problem usually solves itself. I asked Dean Hawks if he meant he had licked worry entirely. Yes, he said, I think I can honestly say that my life is now almost totally devoid of worry. I've found, he went on, that if a man will devote his time to securing facts in an impartial, objective way, his worries will usually evaporate in the light of knowledge. Let me repeat that. If a man will devote his time to securing facts in an impartial, objective way, his worries will usually evaporate in the light of knowledge. But what do most of us do? If we bother with facts at all, and Thomas Edison said in all seriousness, there is no expedient to which a man will not resort to avoid the labor of thinking, if we bother with facts at all, we hunt like bird dogs after the facts that bolster up what we already think and ignore all the others. We want only the facts that justify our acts, the facts that fit in conveniently with our wishful thinking and justify our preconceived prejudices. As André Marois put it, everything that is in agreement with our personal desires seems true. Everything that is not puts us into a rage. Is it any wonder, then, that we find it so hard to get at the answers to our problems? Wouldn't we have the same trouble trying to solve a second-grade arithmetic problem if we went ahead on the assumption that 2 plus 2 equals 5? Yet there are a lot of people in this world who make life a hell for themselves and others by insisting that 2 plus 2 equals 5, or maybe 500. What can we do about it? We have to keep our emotions out of our thinking, and as Dean Hawks put it, we must secure the facts in an impartial, objective manner. That's not an easy task when we're worried. When we're worried, our emotions are riding high. But here are two ideas that I've found helpful when trying to step aside from my problems in order to see the facts in a clear, objective manner. 1. When trying to get the facts, I pretend that I'm collecting this information not for myself, but for some other person. This helps me to take a cold, impartial view of the evidence. This helps me eliminate my emotions. 2. While trying to collect the facts about the problem that is worrying me, I sometimes pretend that I'm a lawyer preparing to argue the other side of the issue. In other words, I try to get all the facts against myself, all the facts that are damaging to my wishes, all the facts I don't like to face. Then I write down both my side of the case and the other side of the case, and I generally find that the truth lies somewhere in between these two extremities. Here's the point I'm trying to make. Neither you nor I nor Einstein nor the Supreme Court of the United States is brilliant enough to reach an intelligent decision on any problem without first getting the facts. Thomas Edison knew that, At the time of his death, he had 2,500 notebooks filled with facts about the problems he was facing. So rule one for solving our problems is, get the facts. Let's do what Dean Hawkes did. Let's not even attempt to solve our problems without first collecting all the facts in an impartial manner. However, getting all the facts in the world won't do us any good until we analyze them and interpret them. I have found from costly experience that it's much easier to analyze the facts after writing them down. In fact, merely writing the facts on a piece of paper and stating our problem clearly goes a long way toward helping us reach a sensible decision. As Charles Kettering puts it, a problem well stated is a problem half solved. Let me show you all of this as it works out in practice. Since the Chinese say one picture is worth 10,000 words, suppose I show you a picture of how one man put exactly what we're talking about into concrete action. Let's take the case of Galen Litchfield, a man I've known for several years, one of the most successful American businessmen in the Far East. Mr. Litchfield was in China in 1942 when the Japanese invaded Shanghai. And here's his story as he told it to me while a guest in my home. Shortly after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Galen Litchfield began, they came swarming into Shanghai. I was the manager of the Asia Life Insurance Company in Shanghai. They sent us an army liquidator. He was really an admiral, and gave me orders to assist this man in liquidating our assets. I didn't have any choice in the matter. I could cooperate or else, and the or else was certain death. I went through the motions of doing what I was told because I had no alternative. But there was one block of securities worth $750,000 which I left off the list I gave to the admiral. I left that block of securities off the list because they belonged to our Hong Kong organization and had nothing to do with the Shanghai assets. All the same, I feared I might be in hot water if the Japanese found out what I'd done, and they soon found out. I wasn't in the office when the discovery was made, but my head accountant was there. He told me that the Japanese admiral flew into a rage and stamped and swore and called me a thief and a traitor. I had defied the Japanese army. I knew what that meant. I would be thrown into the bridge house. The bridge house, the torture chamber of the Japanese Gestapo. I had had personal friends who had killed themselves rather than be taken to that prison. I had other friends who had died in that place after 10 days of questioning and torture. Now I was slated for the bridge house myself. What did I do? I heard the news on Sunday afternoon. I suppose I should have been terrified, and I would have been terrified if I hadn't had a definite technique for solving my problems. For years, whenever I was worried, I had always gone to my typewriter and written down two questions, and the answer to these questions. 1. What am I worrying about? 2. What can I do about it? I used to try to answer those questions without writing them down, but I stopped that years ago. I found that writing down both the questions and the answers clarifies my thinking. So that Sunday afternoon, I went directly to my room at the Shanghai YMCA and got out my typewriter. I wrote, 1. What am I worrying about? I am afraid I will be thrown into the bridge house tomorrow morning. Then I typed out the second question. 2. What can I do about it? I spent hours thinking out and writing down the 4 courses of action I could take, and what the probable consequences of each action would be. 1. I can try to explain to the Japanese admiral, but he doesn't speak English. If I try to explain to him through an interpreter, I may stir him up again. That might mean death, for he is cruel, would rather dump me in the bridge house than bother talking about it. 2. I can try to escape. Impossible. They keep track of me all the time. I have to check in and out of my room at the YMCA. If I try to escape, I'll probably be captured and shot. 3. I can stay here in my room and not go near the office again. If I do, the Japanese admiral will be suspicious, will probably send soldiers to get me and throw me into the bridge house without giving me a chance to say a word. 4. I can go down to the office as usual on Monday morning. If I do, there's a chance that the Japanese admiral may be so busy that he will not think of what I did. Even if he does think of it, he may have cooled off and may not bother me. If this happens, I'm all right. Even if he does bother me, I'll still have a chance to try to explain to him. So, going down to the office as usual on Monday morning and acting as if nothing had gone wrong gives me two chances to escape the bridge house. As soon as I thought it all out and decided to accept the fourth plan, to go down to the office as usual on Monday morning, I felt immensely relieved. When I entered the office the next morning, the Japanese admiral sat there with a cigarette dangling from his mouth. He glared at me, as he always did, and said nothing. 6 weeks later, thank God, he went back to Tokyo, and my worries were ended. As I've already said, I probably saved my life by sitting down that Sunday afternoon and writing out all the various steps I could take.